Good afternoon and welcome to Frankly Speaking About Cancer with the Cancer Support Community. Your host is Kim Tibaldo, President and CEO of the Cancer Support Community. This hour is designed to inspire, inform, and to help you live better with cancer. Now, here's your host, Kim Tibaldo.
Welcome to Frankly Speaking About Cancer, an internet radio show that focuses on informing and inspiring people to live well with cancer. I'm your host, Kim Tibaldo, CEO of the Cancer Support Community. For more than 35 years, we at the Cancer Support Community have been a relentless ally for anyone impacted by cancer. We help individuals manage the realities of this disruptive disease and get back to normal. Whether accessing our free services in person or at one of our 175 locations around the country, online, or over our toll-free helpline, you're getting a team of licensed professionals providing patient navigation, financial counseling, genetic counseling, pediatric support, and more. Well, I've been hosting Frankly Speaking About Cancer for about 10 years now, and I can honestly say that today's episode may be the most important I've ever recorded, because in this episode of our special series, Spotlight on Coronavirus, we're going to take a close look at the vaccines we have been hearing so much about that will help us combat the COVID-19 pandemic. We're going to learn about how they work, the approval process with the FDA, and importantly, what it means for cancer patients and their caregivers. I know there are a lot of questions. We're going to dive in. Before we get started, I just want to mention to our listeners that the show is not intended as medical advice. We're going to have a good conversation, learn as much as we can, but we certainly encourage you to talk to your doctor about your own situation, about the vaccine, and if the vaccine is appropriate for you. So the discussion today is for informational purposes only. So let me introduce our amazing panel that we have with us today. First, we have Dr. Kathleen Dooling. Dr. Dooling is Chief Medical Officer for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, and CDC co-lead on the ACIP COVID-19 Vaccines Working Group. Next, we have Dr. Elizabeth Robilotti. Dr. Robilotti is the Associate Medical Epidemiologist at Memorial Hospital for Cancer and Allied Diseases and an attending physician with the Infectious Disease Service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. Her clinical focus is on the management of infectious complications in patients with cancer, and her research interests are in outbreak mitigation and the prevention of healthcare-associated infections through the combined efforts of antimicrobial stewardship and infection prevention strategies. Dr. Michael Ibarra is a board-certified emergency physician and vice president of medical affairs and strategic alliances as pharma. In addition to his work at pharma, Dr. Ibarra works clinically in the emergency department at MedStar Georgetown University Hospital. He brings a unique perspective to the discussion as a frontline provider treating COVID-19 patients. So again, we're so excited to have this incredible expertise. We have a lot to talk about in a short time, so we're going to jump right in. Dr. Robilotti, I'm going to start with you. So let's start with the basics, Dr. Robilotti. Can you explain, really, as if you're teaching middle school science, what vaccines are and how they work? I want to make sure we're all sort of on the same page as we start this important conversation.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, and I think it's really helpful to get our discussion on coronavirus vaccines started with this important basic question. When we get exposed to viruses like influenza or coronaviruses, they can set up shop in our bodies and multiply. This is called infection. And our immune systems fight infection with various cells called white blood cells. A vaccine is like a blueprint for your immune system to make very specialized white blood cells that can defend us against a specific infection. So if you ever get exposed to the virus that you've been vaccinated against, you already have an army of dedicated immune cells to defend you.
Terrific. Really a good level setting so we can kind of understand where we're going with this conversation, Dr. Robilotti. I'm going to stay with you for a moment. We've been hearing a lot about this term herd immunity. Can you help our listeners understand what herd immunity is and why it sometimes comes up during conversations about vaccines?
Sure. Another important topic that's been out in the press. Viruses need someone to infect to keep an outbreak going. And if they don't find anyone that they can make sick, then the outbreak fizzles out. So herd immunity is the idea that a population has enough people who are protected from getting sick so that the virus can't continue to spread. Now, herd immunity can be generated in two ways. One, based on getting infected with the virus and recovering from it, or two, through vaccination. And here it's really important to point out that vaccines are a safe way to generate herd immunity and stop disease transmission without the consequence of people actually having to suffer from the disease you're trying to protect against.
Understood, and I think a very important distinction for sure. Dr. Dooling, at the Cancer Support Community, we tell patients to always be sure to ask their medical team about the goal of the treatment being recommended to them. So let's do some basics here as well. Dr. Dooling, what is the goal of the vaccines that are being developed to combat COVID-19?
Thanks, Kim. Let me start with by saying that the goals of vaccination are often different from what we usually think the goals are when taking medicine. When you receive a vaccine, not only you receive the benefit, but the potential benefit is shared in your community, too. If you are less likely to be infected, you're often less likely to spread that infection to others in your community. And the goals of the COVID-19 vaccination program really bring that to a whole new level. If we can get enough people in our communities vaccinated against COVID-19, we actually have the potential to stop the epidemic spread of this virus in our community.
And so that is the goal of the vaccine, is to stop the epidemic spread of COVID-19.
In addition to the benefits that the individual person will receive in decreasing your likelihood of becoming infected.
Right, right. Got it. So, Dr. Dooling, I think it's fair to say that the whole nation has really been glued to their favorite news outlet over the past few weeks, waiting to hear if any of these vaccines in development would be approved by the FDA. We're at a point where that has happened, which is exciting. But I want to understand what that sort of process is a little bit. And we've heard that the FDA was being asked to give emergency use authorization to these vaccines. Dr. Dooling, what is emergency use authorization? What does that mean, and how is it different from a regular approval of a drug by the FDA?
So emergency use authorization is a term that FDA uses in very special circumstances where there's an active public health emergency ongoing. And that allows a pathway to allow for use of a vaccine in this case in a shorter period of time than would otherwise be the case if there had not been a public health emergency. And to give a very specific example, it's common for vaccines safety testing to go on for 6 months after a person receives the vaccine. In this particular case, people were followed up for an average of 2 months after they received this vaccine. So it's a small difference, but that's a tangible difference in the emergency use authorization compared to regular licensure of a vaccine.
And so we shouldn't expect in the future the FDA to work at such breakneck speed to approve other drugs that are being considered.
Well, again, that declaration of a public health emergency is what allows this pathway.
What allows it. Got it. And I think with that in mind, Dr. Dooling, and I think this is top of mind for a lot of citizens, the vaccines have been developed at record speed. Should that concern us? Were corners cut in the science or the research? Has anything like this ever happened before?
There is no doubt that going from identification of a virus and sequencing it to an authorized vaccine in less than a year is truly outstanding, and it is a testament to scientific achievement, really. But I think just looking at the past year doesn't really tell the whole story of vaccine development and how we got where we are today. SARS, many of your listeners will remember, emerged almost 20 years ago, and that was a novel coronavirus, and we learned a lot from that experience. We were able to get fingerprints of sorts to understand what kind of proteins it had on its surface and to be able to understand how it infected and how it caused harm. We learned a lot from MERS, another novel coronavirus that emerged. And what that taught us was we need better technology to enable the development of vaccines really quickly when a novel that virus emerges like this. So that work has been going on for really more than the past decade. So although this is an incredible achievement to have achieved this vaccine in such record speed, we really need to think about what we've learned over the past two decades that enabled us to get here at the point we find ourselves in.
Got it. Got some good level setting for us to understand that timing. Dr. Abar, before we go to break, we've got a couple minutes until our first break here. Let me bring you into the conversation. Both Pfizer and Moderna have reported that their vaccines are around, they say, 95% effective, which sounds extraordinary. But what does that really mean? So so as a point of comparison, how effective is the flu shot or chickenpox? And 95% sounds great, but how do you know if you might be in the 5% where it's not effective?
Certainly. Well, first, Kim, thanks for having me. It's great to be on. I appreciate all the work you're doing to support the cancer community during this pandemic. And you're right, the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines work very, very well, and we're really excited about the positive data. And the way that I think about it is I kind of think of the clinical trial that both Pfizer and Moderna did, the phase three clinical trial. They enrolled thousands of people. They kind of created this small city. And then in that city, they gave half of the participants vaccine and then the other half placebo, which is basically a shot of saline, doesn't have that protection that the vaccine could have. And so what they did then was allow folks to go out and live their lives. And then they observed cases of symptomatic COVID-19 in that city that they created. And what they found is that the vast majority of cases of coronavirus, you know, about 95% of them were in people who got the placebo or saline shot, so did not get the vaccine. So that 95% efficacy number is really, really high, and it puts it on par with other vaccines that are highly effective, like measles, which is often considered the gold standard, which I believe has about 98% efficacy. And that's also much greater than what we see with the annual flu vaccine that has about 40 to 60% efficacy. So it's really, really exciting data. You know, we don't know exactly who or why the small number of people that got vaccine also got COVID. But the good news is that the vaccine arm, the group of folks that got vaccine, were much, much less likely to get severe infection. So that's the thing we're very afraid of. Of course, we're afraid of, you know, the pandemic is right. One issue, and then people getting COVID is another, and then the severe infection is the third.
Got it. We will pick this up after the break. We're going to take a quick commercial break, but don't go away. We've got so much more to discuss with our guests. We're going to continue to drill down on the COVID-19 vaccines, how they've been developed, when and will they be available to folks, what the impact is for folks, particularly with cancer. We're going to continue to walk through this process with our three guests. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer. I'm Kim Thibodeau. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Effective cancer treatment requires more than just medication or surgery. For the country's 12 million cancer survivors and their loved ones, the social and emotional challenges of adapting to life with cancer are ongoing. How to handle coworkers' questions, how to get comfortable with new physical realities, how to reassure worried family members, or explain to friends your priorities have changed. The cancer support community is ready to help by providing free counseling, education, and hope for survivors and their caregivers. Whether online or at over 100 locations around the world, the cancer support community is ready to offer the support you need to live a better life with cancer. For more information on support groups, publications, nutrition, exercise programs, and more, call 1-888-793-9355 or visit us online at www.cancersupportcommunity.org. That's cancersupportcommunity.org. The Cancer Support Community, a global network of education and hope.
Cancer, it's a lonely word. Terms I don't understand. Choices I never thought I'd have to make. But there is hope and help.
Support from cancer survivors.
Links to research and clinical trials.
Help with finances and access to care.
All behind you a breakaway from cancer. Created by Amgen to empower cancer patients.
The cancer support community is proud to be a partner of Breakaway from Cancer.
Have you friended us on Facebook yet?
Why not?
Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for the keywords Voice America. Once you are part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the Voice America Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our timeline. Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for Voice America.
You're listening to Frankly Speaking About Cancer with the Cancer Support Community, an inspirational program offering the resources you need to live a better life with cancer. Now here's your host, Kim Tibaldo, President and CEO of the Cancer Support Community.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking About Cancer. I'm your host, Kim Tibaldo. Today's episode is part of our special series Spotlight on Coronavirus. We're taking a close look at the vaccines being developed to combat the pandemic, which has impacted everyone really in our country, but especially folks living with cancer, a particularly vulnerable group. With us today are Dr. Kathleen Dooling of the CDC, Dr. Elizabeth Robilotti of Memorial Sloan Kettering, and Dr. Michael Ibarra, board-certified emergency physician at MedStar Georgetown University Hospital and Vice President of Medical Affairs and Strategic Alliances at Pharma. Dr. Dooling, at least in broad terms, can you walk us through the sort of priority groups that are receiving the vaccine? What decisions have been made? I know a lot of those decisions, you know, are made locally, but what have some of the recommendations been about who should get it along the line here?
Sure. At the national level, it's an advisory group called the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP, that advises CDC on things such as should vaccines be used, and if so, in whom. So this group has made a couple of recommendations so far. First, that healthcare personnel and people who live in long-term care facilities receive the vaccine first. And it should be noted that when we speak of healthcare personnel, that's a very broad category. That means that everyone from the person who's checking you in for your hospital visit to the person who is making meals, cleaning the floors, the nurse that's taking your blood pressure, and the physician that's examining you, all of that, all of the entire care community are recommended to receive the vaccine. The additional groups that have been prioritized for phase one include essential workers. In addition, people at high risk of getting severely sick with COVID, and also older adults.
Terrific. I think that's very helpful, Dr. Dooling. I'm not sure if there's an answer to this question, but can a person find out what group they belong to or get a sense of when they might be, you know, be vaccinated? Obviously, we're talking today about, you know, cancer patients and their caregivers. Obviously, I, just as a small testimonial, my parents connected with their doctor. My parents are seniors. They both have some underlying conditions. And basically, he said, you know, start calling in January. We don't really know, but start calling us in January and we'll, you know, keep you posted as, you know, as the program rolls out. But Dr. Dooling, is that the best approach? Connect with your doctor. Are there any other resources to help folks kind of understand where they fit?
Yeah, so people with cancer are at high risk of developing severe COVID. We don't really yet know people who have a history of cancer and have recovered what their level of risk is, but we do know that the people who actively have cancer are in that high risk group. And the specifics of where and when vaccine is going to be available in your community, really it's best to sort of pay attention locally, be aware of what your cancer resources in your neighborhood, and be aware of what your local public health is telling people about which groups are ready to receive vaccine and where they can go to get it.
Terrific. And Dr. Dooling, I think this is important. I know there are other vaccines in development. I know some have been delayed, maybe due to less than expected results. We have an entire world of billions of people that we're trying to immunize. But what will the impact of some of those delays be? Do we think there's going to be enough vaccine for everyone who wants to be vaccinated? I know that these delays may extend us out a little bit further into 2021 and maybe even beyond, I imagine.
Well, there will be enough vaccine for everyone. The degree to which the vaccines that are licensed and authorized can scale up their production and how quickly we get more vaccines achieving authorization is yet to be known. But I think it's important for people to know that if they are younger, if they're healthy, if they can work from home, that means you might have to wait a little bit longer while people are older and at higher risk or who are providing essential services to the community, wait a little bit longer.
Got it. Got it. Makes sense. I think it makes sense, and the prioritization, you know, makes a lot of sense for sure. Dr. Ribellotti, I would love for our listeners to have a better understanding of how some of these vaccines, particularly for COVID-19, help to build immunity to the virus. I know in some vaccines we actually give people a small dose of the virus to help activate their immune system. Is that what's happening here with the COVID-19 vaccine?
You're partially right. It's important to let listeners know that the COVID vaccines do not actually give you COVID. The vaccine strategies for COVID are based on the idea of giving the immune system a small signal, usually a protein part of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, that can be used by immune cells to generate a response. And specifically here, we're talking about T cells and B cells, which are types of lymphocytes or immune cells. And these cells will recognize your own cells that have been infected by COVID and eliminate them. And they'll also produce antibodies to the virus that can attack any intruding fragments of virus to help keep you safe from COVID.
Got it. Dr. Abar, let's drill down on that a little bit, because my understanding is that that this vaccine is really a new mechanism of action, right, which is a term about how a drug works, right? So that this is a new mechanism of action, and that is called mRNA. So Dr. Abar, what does that mean? Uh-huh. First of all, kind of break that down for us a little bit more, and how, you know, what that means and how it works. And then, I've heard some people have some concern about, okay, kind of you're messing with my DNA or my RNA, or is it going to change my genes or my DNA in any way? And I'd love to just get into that a little bit, Dr. Ibarra.
Sure. Well, maybe I'll start there and say, no, it does not affect your DNA. It doesn't go near your cell's nucleus. And this is an exciting approach. I like what Dr. Ribellotti said, because I get that question a lot as well. I think when people hear vaccine, they immediately think that they're kind of getting like an inactivated whole virus or, you know, some sort of attenuated form that might make them sick. And that's not really the approach that's being looked at, in particular with these mRNA vaccines that have been authorized. There's not a risk that you're going to get COVID from getting the vaccine. And I do hear that a lot, so I just wanted to drill down on that as well. The approach that Pfizer and mRNA are, that Moderna are investigating is called the mRNA approach. And what they do is basically give your body a small strand of mRNA, messenger RNA, that encodes for a protein called the spike protein. And if you've ever seen the coronavirus on TV, it's a circle that has these little spikes on the outside. And what this is doing is it's teaching your body to recognize that spike protein, so that if you're ever exposed to COVID-19 or the coronavirus, your body would recognize that it's foreign. It's already developed immunity to it because you got the vaccine, and then you'd be able to fight it. So it's a really innovative approach that, to your question, does not change your DNA. It doesn't go to your cell nucleus and make any changes to your DNA. It just primes your immune system to recognize that little spike protein on the outside of the coronavirus that we've all seen.
Got it. And I think we've also all read, Dr. Ibarra, that both of these vaccines, I believe Pfizer and Moderna, require two doses. So just talk about that for a minute. Why two doses? What's the timing between the first and the second? What if we're off on the timing of that? You know, give us some background there.
Sure, yeah. Well, the first dose is kind of the primer, kind of telling your immune system to get ready. And then the second dose is really the boost that it needs to get you to that full 95% protection that we've been talking about and that you've been hearing in the news. So it is really important that you get the second dose. The vaccine manufacturers have slightly different timing. And so one really great strategy that I've seen, my ER colleagues that are getting vaccinated now, the government, the HHS, when you get your vaccine, they're actually giving you a card that says which vaccine you got and when you need to come back. So it's a really simple way. It's a good old-fashioned reminder card that we always give out for doctor's visits appointments. But it is really important that you get the dose at the right time from the same manufacturer that you got your initial dose. And it's 21 days recommended for Pfizer, 28 days for Moderna. And there are kind of reminder cards, but, you know, everybody should do their part in kind of remembering it. We all have smartphones. Take a picture of that card in case you lose it. Set a reminder. So when we're all lucky enough to get the shot, we want to make sure that we do it as per the FDA recommendations and the manufacturer recommendations about getting that booster shot.
So I know it's important, Dr. Ibarra. I know it's a real priority, but sometimes life gets in the way. Sometimes we lose mm-hmm. that card. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we forget when we got that
yeah.
first shot. So what happens if you're off uh-huh. on timing? What if it's not exactly 21 days,
sure.
Not exactly sure. 28 days? And frankly, what happens if you don't go back at all and get a second dose?
Certainly. Well, if you don't get a second dose, then you're not getting that full protection that we've been talking about. The vaccine protection, for example, the Pfizer data showed that you reach that 95% protection from COVID about 7 days after that second shot. So it's important that you get both shots so you get the full protection of the vaccine. You do get a little mm-hmm. bit of protection after the first vaccine, but the way that they're being authorized is for the two-dose regimen. And, and I totally am with you. Sometimes things happen. Sometimes appointment days fall on a weekend when it might not be offered. There's a little bit of wiggle room there. So, for example, okay. if 28 days is on Sunday, they might tell you to come in on Monday, and that's totally fine. There is a
Got
little
it.
Bit of wiggle room, but obviously, we all should strive to meet that timing that the FDA authorization has spelled out.
Great. Terrific. Good advice. Good recommendations. We are going to take a quick break here. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer. Dr. Dooling, I wish you could stay with us longer. You've been so helpful in really helping us understand what's happening here, but we know you have to return to your duties at the CDC, and those are important duties. So we wish you well in this continued work and research. Thank you for making time to be with us today. I'm going to say to our other guests, Dr. Ribellotti, Dr. Ibarra, please don't go away. We still have a lot to learn. We have a lot more questions. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer. We're talking today about the COVID-19 vaccines. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Effective cancer treatment requires more than just medication or surgery. For the country's 12 million cancer survivors and their loved ones, the social and emotional challenges of adapting to life with cancer are ongoing. How to handle coworkers' questions, how to get comfortable with new physical realities, how to reassure worried family members, or explain to friends your priorities have changed. The Cancer Support Community is ready to help by providing free counseling, education, and hope for survivors and their caregivers. Whether online or at over 100 locations around the world, the Cancer Support Community is ready to offer the support you need to live a better life with cancer. For more information on support groups, publications, nutrition, exercise programs, and more, call 1-888-793-9355 or visit us online at www.cancersupportcommunity.org. That's cancersupportcommunity.org. The Cancer Support Community, a global network of education and hope.
Cancer, it's a lonely word. Terms I don't understand. Choices I never thought I'd have to make. But there is hope and help.
Support from cancer survivors.
Links to research and clinical trials.
Help with finances and access to care.
All behind you at Breakaway from Cancer, created by Amgen to empower cancer patients.
The cancer support community is proud to be a partner of Breakaway from Cancer.
Have you friended us on Facebook yet?
Why not?
Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for the keywords Voice America. Once you are part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the Voice America Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our timeline. Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for Voice America.
Thank you. You're listening to Frankly Speaking About Cancer with the Cancer Support Community, an inspirational program offering the resources you need to live a better life with cancer. Now here's your host, Kim Tibaldo, President and CEO of the Cancer Support Community.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking About Cancer. I'm your host, Kim Tibaldo. We are continuing our important conversation about vaccines and how they can help to combat the COVID-19 pandemic here with Dr. Elizabeth Robilotti and Dr. Michael Ibarra. Still so much more ground to cover. I know we're moving quickly, guys, but, you know, we've got just a lot of ground to cover. It's such an important conversation, and you guys are just terrific, so we appreciate the ongoing conversation. Dr. Ibarra, we kind of closed out the last segment, just talking a little bit about why there are two doses that are required, and again, I know for Pfizer versus Moderna, there's a different space between vaccine one, vaccine two. Can you just kind of reiterate that for our listeners? Why two doses? What's the space between, and how important is it to go and get that second dose?
Yeah, certainly. Happy to. Just to reiterate, the vaccines that have been authorized to date are two doses. The first dose is kind of the introduction that your immune system needs, and then the second is that boost that gives you the full kind of 95% protection that we've been talking about. And it is really important that you get both doses, that you follow kind of the date and time needed, because each manufacturer at this point has slightly different recommendations. And they are handing out cards when you get the vaccine to indicate when you need to come back for your second shot. It's 21 days for the Pfizer vaccine and 28 days for Moderna. There's a little bit of wiggle room, though, as I was saying. So if your 28 days falls on a Sunday and the clinic's not open, they'll probably tell you to come back on Monday, and that's totally fine. The other thing just to be aware of, it's important to keep track of this, and that's why that card is really critical, because there are going to be other vaccines on the market, or we all hope that there will be other vaccines on the market here soon. For example, Johnson & Johnson is investigating a vaccine that actually will be one shot. So it's all the more important and all the reason to kind of have these cards to keep track of what you got. I made the comment, you know, take a picture of your card with your smartphone, you know, do other kind of tips and tricks to keep track of that date. It's really important to get the booster if you need it so that you get the full protection that the vaccine has.
Great advice, great tips for sure. We seem to take pictures of everything else with those phones, Dr. Ibarra.
That's right.
Take a picture of that card, plop that little reminder in our calendar, and make sure we're good to go. This is pretty important. So appreciate those tips and that good advice. Dr. Robilotti, at this point, do we know how long the immunity from these vaccines will last? For example, I know we go every year and get that flu shot and get that the new flu shot, the new formulation. Do we have any sense of whether this is going to be an annual trek for us to get these two shots or how long the immunity will last?
So that's a really hot topic of research, the short answer is no, we don't know the duration of immunity yet. Just looking at the natural immunity from people who've been infected by COVID, you know, it's on the order of several months, most likely, and probably depends on the severity of their initial infection. Now, with the vaccine strategies, they've been designed to really maximize that so that the hope is that the duration will be more akin to people who've had severe COVID as opposed to mild COVID. But we honestly don't know, and it's an area of research that will be followed in the trial cohort population. So patients who've been enrolled in both the Pfizer and Moderna trial, for example, are going to be followed out for up to 2 years looking at things like exactly how robust the immune response is and how long it lasts. The other key part of that question, though, is the one other thing we don't know about COVID is actually what the minimum level of immune response is needed to prevent infection or to prevent severe disease. So there are some instances where, you know, our ability to detect your antibody on the tests that we use to look for antibodies may say it's negative, but you actually do have sufficient antibody to ward off infection. And these are not known yet, but definitely things researchers are looking at.
Dr. Robilotti, will that antibody testing become more into the mainstream? I know you're talking about, you know, testing and tracking people who've been in the trial and tracking them for years out from the trial. Will there be a point in time or a day when the average person can get their antibodies tested?
So there are some places that are doing antibody testing. It's mostly in a research context. We don't actually use the antibody testing to make clinical decisions about patients, nor do we use it to suggest who should or should not be vaccinated.
Got it. So, Dr. Robilotti, you know, we're a cancer organization, and I'm not telling anything you don't know when I say that cancer patients and their caregivers have been following the news about vaccines closely. They've been a particularly affected population, a vulnerable population in many ways. What do we know so far about this? Should cancer patients get vaccinated? Are there certain cancer patients who should, who should not? I'm thinking of patients, again, maybe on chemotherapy who have a weakened immune system. On the other hand, there are patients taking immunotherapy and their immune systems may already be boosted or on overdrive. What do we know? What do we not know? And frankly, maybe most helpful, Dr. Robilotti, what questions should patients be asking when they're discussing the COVID vaccines with their medical team?
Thanks for this. This is, I think, a really important topic for your listeners in particular. So just to be frank, the data on performance of COVID vaccines in cancer patients is not known at this time, and there are plans to extend the studies of the different vaccine candidates in what we would call immunocompromised populations. But what you're asking about is more specifically in specific oncology populations, so patients with solid tumors or patients who have had bone marrow transplant. And these are really immunologically very distinct populations. And I would encourage cancer patients to speak specifically with their oncologist to find out if vaccination is right for them, given their underlying type of cancer, as well as where they are in the course of their treatment. So, for example, a person who is imminently undergoing bone marrow transplant, we don't traditionally give any vaccines in that setting, but there are protocols for vaccination after recovery of immune function because you want to give somebody a vaccine and have them be able to generate an immune response. So that would be an important type of question. Is it the right time in my treatment course to receive vaccines? For other patients who may be on chemotherapy that's not necessarily as immunosuppressing as some types of treatment, the answer may be yes, this is the right time to give you vaccine, knowing full well that perhaps they may not achieve the same kind of robust immune response as patients in the clinical trial for COVID vaccine, but they may achieve a level of protection that kind of takes them out of the danger zone for getting actual COVID infection.
This
is something that...
Please.
Go ahead. We can move on to the next question.
Okay. I would imagine that when the caregiver, if someone with cancer qualifies to get it, that certainly they should get it because it would certainly increase the protection of the patient, correct?
For sure. We recommend it for flu vaccine. We recommend it for lots of other vaccines. And the most important take-home message for both caregivers and patients is that from what we've seen so far for the Pfizer and Moderna products, these are very safe vaccines.
Great. So let's get to that a little bit, Dr. Ibarra. What are some of the side effects that folks might experience? What does the data tell us that folks experience when they're taking the vaccines? I know we've seen on the news some folks have had some severe, small number of people, a severe allergic reaction, but those numbers, you can count them on a hand or two hands. What do we know about that, about the side effects?
Sure. Well, while you can't get COVID, I'll just say it again, you can't get COVID from the vaccine, you can experience side effects of the vaccine, so it is good to prepare for them. And you did mention the couple of allergic reactions that are still under investigation, trying to get to the bottom of that, what happened, if it's from the vaccine or if it's from something else. We don't know the circumstances enough to draw any conclusions from that at this point in time. And it's important to reiterate also that in the clinical trials, there were no serious safety signals that the FDA warned us about. But they did warn about common side effects that are kind of consistent with what we see from other very effective vaccines. And side effects can also just indicate that your immune system is basically activating. It's kind of getting ready for the big fight. So it's like a good workout that you might have before kind of a marathon or a big game. And the FDA does include in the label of the product or the authorization of the product the side effects that you might anticipate. There are some commonalities, but it's important to kind of look at the specifics for the vaccine that you're getting. But some common reactions we see with very effective vaccines are low-grade fever or pain at the injection site. Maybe you just feel a little bit tired or worn down, but they tend to be pretty short-lived. And then they also tend to be milder for the first shot than the second shot, which I think makes sense intuitively that first shot is your kind of first exposure and the second one is your booster where your immune system is really kind of ramping up, so you might feel a little bit more of the side effects, the second injection as opposed to the first one.
And so the side effects means your system's working, right? That you're responding.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, you obviously don't want to feel, uncomfortable, but it's also a good thing to know that your immune system is reacting to it.
Right, right. We've only got a quick minute until the break, Dr. Ibarra, but just some language that you used, I want to clarify. You said in the trials there were no serious safety signals. What does that mean? Does that mean nobody died? What does that mean?
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, so that's a great clarification. That's kind of a buzzword that we use, but for everyone listening that's not in the weeds on all these clinical trials, what that means is there were common side effects, but there wasn't anything big that jumped out as a serious concern that would make it unsafe for the FDA to authorize it. So there was nothing major found in these large clinical trials where they created these studies, of people to look at the effectiveness of the vaccine, the efficacy of the vaccine. There was nothing that jumped out as a serious safety concern. So these are really big clinical trials.
And in tens of thousands of people, correct?
Yep.
Right, in tens
absolutely.
Of thousands
yeah,
of people.
One had 30,
okay.
The other had 44,000.
Right.
These are big clinical trials.
Terrific. We've got more to discuss with our guests. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer. We're going to take a quick break here, but don't go back. More coming.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Effective cancer treatment requires more than just medication or surgery. For the country's 12 million cancer survivors and their loved ones, the social and emotional challenges of adapting to life with cancer are ongoing. How to handle coworkers' questions, how to get comfortable with new physical realities, how to reassure worried family members, or explain to friends your priorities have changed. The Cancer Support Community is ready to help by providing free counseling, education, and hope for survivors and their caregivers. Whether online or at over 100 locations around the world, the Cancer Support Community is ready to offer the support you need to live a better life with cancer. For more information on support groups, publications, nutrition, exercise programs, and more, call 1-888-793-9355 or visit us online at www.cancersupportcommunity.org. That's cancersupportcommunity.org. The Cancer Support Community, a global network of education and hope.
Cancer, it's a lonely word. Terms I don't understand. Choices I never thought I'd have to make. But there is hope and help.
Support from cancer survivors.
Links to research and clinical trials.
Help with finances and access to care.
All behind you at Breakaway from Cancer, created by Amgen to empower cancer patients.
The Cancer Support Community is proud to be a partner of Breakaway from Cancer.
Have you friended us on Facebook yet?
Why not?
Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for the keywords Voice America. Once you are part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the Voice America Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our timeline. Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for Voice America.
You're listening to Frankly Speaking About Cancer with the Cancer Support Community, an inspirational program offering the resources you need to live a better life with cancer. Now here's your host, Kim Tibaldo, President and CEO of the Cancer Support Community.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking About Cancer. I'm Kim Tibaldo. As part of our special series Spotlight on Coronavirus, we've been having a really in-depth conversation about vaccines and how they can help combat the COVID-19 pandemic. We're with Dr. Elizabeth Ribellotti and Dr. Michael Ibarra. Dr. Ibarra, I think this is going to be so interesting for our listeners, but you actually participated in one of the trials for the vaccine, meaning that you got it in your arm. So tell us about that experience. Do you know yet whether you got the vaccine or the placebo? And if you got the placebo, we hope you'll be able to get the vaccine.
It's been quite an experience. I don't know at this moment, but I hope to know soon. I learned an awful lot being a participant, and quite honestly, it was just it's really I don't know. I feel honored to be a participant and happy that I could contribute in this kind of unique way. And you can too. You can go to coronaviruspreventionnetwork.org, which is the website that the NIH set up to kind of create a clearinghouse of individuals interested in participating in research related to COVID-19. So coronaviruspreventionnetwork.org. I went there over the summer. I put my information in, and shortly thereafter, I got a call from a clinical trial coordinator in Maryland, not too far from where I live at University of Maryland, asking if I'd be interested in coming in to participate in the Moderna trial. So I was very motivated to do it. I, like all of you, want this pandemic over as soon as possible. And so participating was one way that I could kind of contribute to help make that possible. And I also spent a lot of time in my day job thinking about clinical trials, working at pharma, you know, what can we do to make the process better for patients? And so I could experience kind of firsthand the transportation issues that you might face if you don't have a car, or how complicated the questions are that you have to go through if you're not a doctor, or even if you are a doctor, how complicated the questions are, and, you know, all of the paperwork that I had to go through. So it's been quite an experience. I don't yet know if I got the vaccine or placebo, but Moderna's plan is to offer what we call crossover, where if you were in the placebo group, you would be given the option to reconsent and get the vaccine, which I will definitely be taking advantage of if I'm in that placebo group. 25% of the Moderna's participants were healthcare workers like me, so I do plan to get vaccinated as quickly as possible while still being able to be in the trial so they can continue to collect the information that they need to collect. But getting vaccinated is really important for all of us. But for me in particular, we're definitely seeing a significant surge of patients with COVID. So I'm definitely anxious to get that question answered here relatively quickly.
I bet you are. And just by the way, bravo to you for being a good citizen and going out and participating in that research. And I also appreciate your bigger picture view, because we do make sometimes participating in trials really hard and complicated for people. So I appreciate that this is giving you a new understanding of the patient experience and some things we can do to help patients kind of overcome those barriers. Dr. Ribellotti, sticking with the sort of cancer conversation for a moment, do we know, can a person still pass the virus? Can they be a carrier and pass it to another person once they've gotten the vaccine?
So we don't actually know that yet. The trials that have been in the news lately have really been focused on preventing COVID disease in an individual and preventing severe disease, which is very important for cancer patients. But they don't assess whether or not these vaccines protect against what we call asymptomatic transmission, which means you have vaccine protection and you don't get sick from it, but you're still transmitting virus. And we hope to know that sometime soon, but we don't know it yet.
And what about, this question keeps coming up as well, Dr. Ribellotti, what about somebody who's had COVID? Should they still get the vaccine? And if so, do we know anything about, you know, how long after they've tested positive for COVID that they should possibly get the vaccine? Any data there yet?
So the current recommendation for that is that patients who've previously had COVID-19 should wait about 3 months, which is about the expected duration of the natural immunity, before getting vaccinated. And they should definitely get the vaccine, because we don't know the duration of the immune response from natural infection. And so vaccination will be a helpful step for them as well.
Understood. Dr. Ibarra, we know that there are still a lot of people who are very skeptical about getting the vaccine. We know that there are, in particular, a lot of skepticism in certain minority communities and communities of color. We know these folks have been disproportionately impacted by COVID, but we have a long and unpleasant history with some of these populations. We won't have time to get into all of that today. But first of all, Dr. Barr, can you tell us, were communities of color represented significantly, or at least proportionately, in the trials, in the vaccine trials? Uh-huh. And secondly, what needs to happen in society for us to help people understand that this is important to do for themselves, for their family, for their community, for society, and that these are really very safe vaccines?
Yeah, certainly. That's a great question. And it's really important that everyone feels like the trial represents them, and so that they feel confident in getting the vaccine. And I really just recently saw Dr. Collins, the director of the National Institutes of Health, was asked a similar question, and he had a fantastic quote, which was that, you know, a white guy from NIH is probably not going to be as effective in convincing somebody from a minority community that this is the kind of science they might want to trust as a doctor from their own community might be. And that's, you know, I'm kind of paraphrasing his quote, but that's what he said. And to me, that, I think, sums it up so well. And vaccine manufacturers did step up to increase the enrollment of minority populations. And so our baseline is very, you know, fairly low, less than, you know, 5% for certain populations, like, for example, Black Americans, around 1% generally for Latinx individuals. And they were able to increase enrollment for these trials to about 20%, which I think is a really, really big step that we need to not lose that progress when it comes to other diseases. And they did innovative things, like they worked directly with, you know, Spanish-speaking health promoters, Black pastors, identifying clinical trial site coordinators and study coordinators, physicians in the community, you know, Black physicians, Latinx physicians, so that people that are enrolling, again, they feel that sense of trust because they're, you know, they represent the community that they're serving. So I think those are all really important steps. And the key thing is that we've learned a lot. We've got a long way to go, but we don't want to certainly backslide when it comes to other disease areas when the pandemic is over.
Got it. Understood. Dr. Rebelotti, we're down to our last minute or so here, but everybody wants to know when we can get back to normal. Can we get back to normal after we're vaccinated? Should we still be wearing masks? What is this going to look like post-vaccination?
Yeah, I'm not sure we're ever going to get back to pre-COVID, because I think a lot of things have changed, maybe some for the better, one can hope. In this period when we're rolling out vaccine to people, and as Dr. Ibarra noted, the vaccines require two doses, at least the two that are currently being rolled out, it's still really important to practice a lot of the behaviors and prevention strategies that we've been using in the pre-vaccine era. So social distancing, wearing a mask, limiting your contact with others, and frequent hand hygiene are really going to be the tools that will help us get to the point where our population is vaccinated against COVID.
Mm-hmm. And maybe also help us in general with public health and flu and all those other, all those
yeah,
other things. That,
for sure. Can We've certainly from seen those, this flu season is lower than anything.
Yeah, which is amazing. I mean, it just goes to show that we do have some good tools that are in our hands, literally, to help combat some of these things. So this has just been a really fabulous conversation. I'm so grateful to both of you for your work that you're doing to support patients, for your expertise, and all that you've shared today. I know that we're, you know, sort of charting new territory, and we're learning a lot together here, but we really appreciate all of your expertise, all of your sharing today. We're going to come back to you. We're going to ask you to come back again, because we know this narrative is changing by the day, and we look forward to continue to share with patients and family members and others who we know listen into the show and really rely on our show for some good information. I just want to remind folks who are listening at the Cancer Support Community, we've got a host of free resources for people impacted by cancer. So please don't hesitate to reach out to us. Our website is cancersupportcommunity.org, or you can call us at 888-793-9355 to talk to one of our navigators. Our services are free for anybody with any kind of cancer, for the caregivers, for the loved ones. So cancersupportcommunity.org, 888-793-9355. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer. I'm Kim Thibodeau. Until next time, be well, do well, live well.
thank you for joining us for Frankly Speaking About Cancer with your host, Kim Tibaldo. We're here for you every Tuesday afternoon at 1 p.m. Pacific Time and 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. In the meantime, stay connected online at cancersupportcommunity.org. That's cancersupportcommunity.org.